The views expressed in this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware.
WVUD presents Campus Voices, conversations with University of Delaware faculty, staff, and students about their teaching, research, service projects, and other interests. To introduce today's guest, here's your host, Richard Gordon.
Hi, I'm Richard Gordon from WVUD's Campus Voices.
And I'm Lisa Sawicki from Science Rocks on the Basement.
And we are here today in one of four of the university's galleries, part of the University Museums, with Sharon Fitzgerald, the curator of the Mineralogical Museum, and Ivan Henderson. Your title is Curator of Education, and we're here to talk about the Mineralogical Museum and the museums in general. Sharon, how long has the Mineralogical Museum been here?
Well, in the form that you're seeing today, we opened in 2009. We've been here ever since this became the geology department in 1970. It was a much smaller room then, very different cases and a different layout, but it's been here since then.
And the Mineralogical Museum is located in Penny Hall at 255 Academy Street. Ivan, where are the other museums located?
The other university museums locations are Old College Gallery, which is, of course, right at 18 East Main Street, right at the main intersection there. Also, Mechanical Hall Gallery is just north and east of Old College. It's 30 North College Avenue.
Now, all four of the museums are open to the public and are open for free. What days?
We are open Wednesday through Sunday, noon to 5 o'clock, except for on Wednesday, we're open till 8.
Well, let's start looking at some of these things. Can we start off with the polished piece of stalactite from Argentina?
Well, we're fortunate to have it's almost 11 inches long stalactite. Not the typical thing you think of a stalactite. Most people picture going into caves in Kentucky or even Pennsylvania and seeing white calcite stalactites hanging down from the ceiling, from the top. You can remember stalactite because it hangs down from the top. Stalagmites grow up. But this is a different story. This is one cave that was found in Argentina in the 1980s. One picture remains, whether there are others, but nobody's found anything but one photograph of that cave, and it was totally collected out and sold for specimens and cut into slabs and is gone, and they've never found another cave. They found other rhodochrosite. It's not an incredibly uncommon mineral in other localities, but not of this nature.
So, again, the name of the mineral that gives it this, its red color is?
Well, the element that gives it the pink color is manganese. It's a manganese mineral. It's a manganese carbonate. So it is like calcite structurally, but it has the manganese that colors it.
What's the unifying theme for all these minerals in this first case we're looking at? Is that they're all from caves?
Yes, they're all from caves. They somewhat form differently. It depends on what sort of cave, but most are involved with water, some kind of water. Either the water has evaporated off, leaving minerals, or sometimes they're half in the water, or they drip the mineral down and form the crystals from the dripping action of water. But water is an important element in how these crystals form.
And there are just so many colors within this case. I was wondering, sort of from the science side, if you could speak a little more. You had mentioned some of the colorations were caused by different minerals in there. Speak to what minerals are present that are causing this wide range of colors. I see red, yellow, deep purples, blues, greens.
Well, the concept of color is a lot more complicated than it was originally thought. Well, it was easily explained by trace elements at one time. So that people thought, okay, amethyst is purple because it has trace elements of iron. It turns out, though, that in the case of most amethyst, it's a lattice defect. So there are lots of other things that come into play. But some are fairly simple. Copper minerals, which azurite and malachite in this case are very commonly green or blue. And they come from large copper deposits, and they're in the oxidized zone. And what happens is, in the case of the Bisbee material here, that mine was discovered in the 1800s. But people found this on the surface. I mean, these beautiful blue crystals, and they started collecting them. And we now know it is a sign of a copper mine, of underlying copper. So after they collected all these minerals and went through this oxidized zone, then they were into an actual copper deposit, which was mined. And, you know, a huge hole in the ground was opened up to mine out the copper. And these minerals now were not found anymore. They were more near surface features.
I think one of the things that people notice pretty quickly in here is, I call it the quartz shark over there in the corner.
Yeah, that's third graders all call it that. The interesting thing about these is, and I get people and adults say the same thing too, is, oh, I'm going to go dig in my backyard and I'm going to find one of these. Well, it's not so easy to do that because we are on the coastal plain and there's no amethyst at all. In Pennsylvania, when you get up into some areas on the Piedmont, they did years ago find amethyst crystals, nothing like this. These are all formed in one area in Brazil and Uruguay, and they actually were a volcanic flow which just had bubbles in it. As it cooled, it just left big holes and bubbles. And the quartz came in secondarily and coated the linings of these bubbles and solidified. So this one area, there's hundreds of them. And it's funny because this one was given to us. It was a donation to one of our donors that had died, and people donated money, and we have this in his memory. But they were very uncommon then, and people thought they were pretty, but yet there was a lot of amethyst on the market. But what it really was is a shipping problem. The Brazilians didn't know how to crate and ship these huge, big things. And so they smashed them up and broke them up, and then you bought little pieces of amethyst. And now that they know how to ship them, there's hundreds of them for sale at some of these big mineral shows. They're really quite common.
I mean, it's a large amethyst piece that you have, and I was wondering, do they know the largest one in the world that's in existence, or is there any information on that, or how did he even get that big?
Well, I've seen ones that people can walk into, and they'll sell them in matched pairs. Now, this one, as you can see, it was chipped away, but now what they do is actually saw them, because they have the saws to be able to do this. And so, you know, there's ones as big as a person, and you can walk in like a room. They make coffee tables out of them. They'll have them like this, and they'll be big, big tables, and put a glass top on them. I mean, they're really pretty magnificent.
Would something like this, you mentioned that some of the things in the case behind me now indicate, you know, certain minerals or metals are there to be mined. Is there anything other than history of a volcanic flow that a big amethyst crystal like this would indicate?
Well, this is not one crystal. You can see the individual crystals. So that these individual crystals formed inside this bubble. And, you know, it's quartz, so it's SiO2, and that's it. There's no other substance whatsoever.
So the outside is also silicon dioxide and just...
Yes. But I think they spray them with something because it's kind of crumbly on the outside. So this is probably kind of just something they've sprayed on it to consolidate it a little bit better.
Now, why don't we walk over to the DuPont cases, and because I think that's really what you're focusing on here in the fall 2015 semester.
Let me explain one thing just because it's kind of interesting. We're called a museum. This is the Mineralogical Museum. And the other museums are called galleries. And the reason that they're called galleries is they have changing exhibitions all the time. But this is we do have changing exhibitions. It's not we don't. But this is our permanent collection. So we have what you see out is about 350 specimens, but we have about 3,000.
Wow.
The permanent collection has about half that, and the study collection has about half that. But because we are a permanent collection, these are all our things. We're not borrowing things. This is why it's called a museum. That's the distinction between that. But anyway, this is something that I've done research on and published on. And so we have rearranged because of our new thinking. When the collection was given to the University of Delaware by Irene DuPont, it was left in his will. He died in 1963, and it came to the university in 1964. And it was packed at Grenogue, which is his house, and it was brought to the university in boxes and put in the basement of the library. This building wasn't geology department at the time. This room wasn't here. And so here we have boxes in the library's basement. Unfortunately, when collectors do that and that happens, we lose the information. We don't know now what we have. So when this became the department and a mineralogist was hired, they brought the room was prepared. They brought the boxes over. No labels, almost no labels on anything. And what do we know? Well, at the time, what was known is, and this is Irene Sr., is that his papers are at Hagley Museum. That was known. So The mineralogist went and looked at some of his papers and found a bill of sale from Tiffany's, George Quinn's of Tiffany and Company, in 1919 for $27,000. Now, that was a lot of money in 1919.
This is $27,000 in 1919.
Right.
So Tiffany's was selling minerals like this.
Right. So that was what was thought at the time. We knew that. So it was thought, well, Irinay bought this collection at Tiffany's, and this is what we have. And we had no list, so we weren't really sure how many. But the thing is that they were the only minerals in this department at the time, so it was known these were all Irinay minerals. So that was what I thought. I was hired in 2007, and that was what I knew. So I did find a couple labels, and going through various things, I found a couple labels. And the one label I found was with these bear. I found a label, and it said Marimba Mine, and I had never heard of it. And so I started researching it. And I didn't know if I didn't know if the labels went with those barrels. I had no idea. I knew they were from Brazil, but I didn't know where, because we didn't have a label. So I started doing some research, and I found that the Marimba Mine was an old mine, long since gone. But it took me to a couple publications. One was called The Mineral Industry. And George Quintz, again, who was at Tiffany's, he was the vice president at Tiffany's, was writing in the annual report about various mineral finds, and he talked about these marimba barrels that had been found. And he said, the five finest ones we found this year, one was 331.3 grams. One was, and he named a couple others. Well, I thought, maybe I'll weigh this. So I weigh this, the largest ones. It's 331.3 grams. And it was George Quince writing about this, and I knew that this had come probably from Tiffany's. So I had a label to that, and I knew where it was from. The problem was, it was found in 1921, and this collection, we thought, was all bought in 1919. So then I realized we really didn't know much about this collection, and that's what started my research.
Now, it's a whole different collection. I mean, all sorts of different things you have out on display, different colors, different sizes.
Well, this is the first one. This is what started Irinay collecting. This is we call it the topaz boulder, and it looks like a fish bowl or something, right? It weighs 19 and a half pounds because topaz is a really, really heavy,
wow,
densely packed mineral. But what happened, I went through Irinay's letters, I went through Quinn's correspondence, and I found that what happened is Irinay walked into Tiffany's in 1919, and he saw this for sale. And he asked how much was it, and George Quince was not there at the time, so they said they would get back to him. And so George Quince got back to him, and he said, yes, you can buy that, but you have to buy the whole collection. And Quince did this. He put together collections for World's Fairs, and wealthy donors would buy the entire case and donate it to, like, the American Museum or the Smithsonian or wherever. So this is pretty typical of how he put together collections. He said he put together a dozen collections in his life, and this was one of them. Probably the last one, too. So then the negotiations went back and forth between Irinay and George Quinn's, and it was very fascinating, both being very strong-willed men. And Irinay would say, I don't want the seashells and the corals. They're very uninteresting to me. And, he'd say, but I want the diamond in matrix. And this was something we know came in the original collection because that was negotiated on. And he said, I want the emerald in the rock, which is there. And, he had a bunch of wants that he had to have. And
so this is a diamond, if you will, in a little piece of rock as it would have been found.
Yes, that's right. And they're very, very uncommon because when diamonds are mined, they're crushed. They run through crushers. And so the rock is, crushed away and the diamonds are loose. And so there are lots of specimens on the market and they're almost all fakes. So it's very easy to get a piece of this rock, drill a hole, and then glue a diamond in the hole, which is what happens.
How do you go about determining if it's fake or real?
Well, you can see there's no glue, and you can really look at under the microscope, and you can look at it's clear enough to see that it really goes where it fits right in there and doesn't
right.
come out.
So it's relatively obvious
to an
expert.
Yes, it is, yeah.
I guess historically, this is just fascinating to me that people wanted to possess collections like this.
Well, and they have for hundreds and hundreds of years. I mean, America's a lot behind that. Of course, the Europeans collected minerals long before anybody was collecting minerals in this country, for sure. Of course, Indians and Native people collected and made fantastic jewelry and did all kind of things with minerals.
Lisa's looking at something here.
Well, I was just looking at the emerald on calcite, and I'm just fascinated how you know, a little, an emerald, or it's pretty big, but it can form within a secondary, you know, mineral. So do you know any, do you know why that happens?
Well, in the case of emeralds, they're contact metamorphosis. So you get them in certain zones, and they'll form with along with the calcite. Mm-hmm. And you know, you can see their shape. They're hexagonal. They're a hexagonal mineral, and you can, even on that one, you can see it kind of on the end. Mm-hmm. And the calcite, of course, is much softer than the emerald. So many times they just, you know, break them out of there. That's why mm-hmm. specimens in matrix a lot of times are considered more collectible mm-hmm. than things that are loose.
Yeah, it's very fascinating that it's just this bright green on a white backdrop.
Right. And it's like you arranged it that way.
Yeah, it does look like it. So
we're all used to in the consumer market to seeing these things isolated, but you're exactly right. I mean, one of the things we can see here at the university's mineralogical museum is we can see several of these, what we think of as gemstones, in their natural, in a small bit of their natural environment.
Well, and like this copper and calcite, you can see those are calcite crystals, and you can see the copper wire around it, but the pink color is with inclusions of copper inside the calcite wow. crystals.
Could you talk a little bit about the blue aquamarine gemstone here? It's quite fascinating because I see a watercolor picture that was used essentially to sell it to DuPont. So I think it's really an interesting story behind that.
It really is. We found this. This is not the original. We wouldn't put it in there because it probably would fade. Hagley has the original, but it's a scan of it that's really representative. But the thing is, they sent it. This was in an era of color photography was not really very good, and it was very expensive and not like it is today. So imagine having, you know, Tiffany's had somebody paint this and send it to Irinae to say, we have this beautiful crystal. This is the exact same size as we're showing you. It's this many carats. And it's the finest that we've ever seen. Are you interested in buying it? And Irinae said, yes, please send it. And can you imagine someone doing that today?
Now, the rest of these cases are, if you will, sort of, you've got more from the DuPont collection, but you've also got about 1, 2, 3, 4, about 8 cases with minerals from all around the world.
Yes, these are from China, and the reason that they're all together is they've been recent donations. They've been given in the last couple of years because with the development in China and mining in China, many, many specimens are coming out. Of course, the Chinese right now are pretty wealthy, even with their stock market going down. And many, many of them are collectors. And so many good specimens never leave China. But we really had very little representation of minerals from China until we had these donations. And it is spectacular to see because these things have all been found pretty recently. This one is an old Chinese specimen that we've had in the collection for years, but all the others have come out in the last 10 years, whereas many of our other minerals in here came out 300 years ago.
As I told you before we started recording, and I'm sure that Lisa in Science Rocks knows more about this than I do, but I'm just fascinated, and you can see it in the collection from China, that no matter how large some of these crystals are, they retain their crystalline shape.
Yeah, and that's what this case kind of shows over here, too. This is even at the third grade level, you know, with kids, you can get them to understand, because first thing you want people to understand, which, believe it or not, many people don't think these are natural. They really think somebody cut them or did something to them. And, of course, polished slabs and carvings, that's true of, but of mineral crystals, no. I mean, it's hard to imagine getting a more perfect crystal than that. It's a big cube of pyrite. That's just something we just purchased this summer, because our other one actually had a crack in it. But, you know, it's just how sharp some of these crystal faces are and how much they look exactly like crystal models that are, these are from the 1880s, these models that they were teaching students how to identify minerals. But it's just phenomenal that, you know, there are these shapes. But a pyrite can form, these are called pyritohedrons, which is a very odd form that nothing else forms, just pyrite, or cubes. But you never get six-sided crystals, or you never would get one that looks like that, because they're not hexagonal. So it doesn't matter how big the pyrite gets, the pyrite stays because the atomic structure is based on that.
In terms of preservation and handling of the crystals, what sort of protocols are in place? Because some of them, the crystals are very fine, and I imagine very easy to break. So what do you do whenever you handle them?
Well, as some people would think, you know, cotton gloves, and people think that in museums, and very few people handle minerals with cotton gloves. It really tends to catch on things, and you actually can do more damage. But one thing I always do wear cotton gloves for is pyrite and some things like that, because the oils in your hand can tend to damage the crystals over time. They're really susceptible to breaking down, and especially in this humid climate. But for something like that, I definitely do. But otherwise, you just end up getting a feel of handling things. There's a couple things I put in this museum I don't ever want to move or touch ever again. They're so fragile and difficult to deal with. But there's a San Francisco mine wolfenite, and there's a couple in the cave case that are just there, and hopefully no one ever has to move them ever again.
You mentioned the wolfenite, and I thought that I was just about to ask you about that, because the wolfenite in this case, I mean, you can see it sort of almost looks like delicate little leaves, delicate orange leaves.
Right, and this is a specimen that's very old. This is from George Quinn's of Tiffany's, but this was probably mined in the late 1800s. When I washed all these things to put them out on display, I started cleaning this, and I was soaking it, and I could see glue in places, and I started pulling crystals off of it, because in the 1880s, people thought, well, this is pretty, but if I glue some other crystals on the outside, it will even look better. Well, that's not considered, you know, a legitimate thing to do anymore. So you remove those kind of things. And it was very obvious what had been glued on and what hadn't been. So we got it back to the original specimen. But it's just pretty fantastic.
Some of these things, even if they're delicate, how long does it take to form? I mean, in geologic time, I mean, it just must take forever to form some of these crystals. Like, how long did it take for that fish over there to get formed?
Well, it's the kind of thing that not so much is known, because it's such a huge range. Some crystals form very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. Gypsum, for instance, in dry beds can form in 6 months, crystals. But some of the tri-state material that's over here, that's three different minerals together, galena, fluorite, they've actually age-dated some of those things, and they found that they're millions of years apart.
Oh, wow.
So that, you know, you have a specimen that you've got fluorite and galena on, but the galena formed millions of years after the fluorite did.
Wow.
And so it's very different on what happens. But most all minerals, with the exception of some things that form in caves and gypsums, are millions of years old.
I know a nice little science experiment for kids in terms of learning crystallization and how things form is to do the sugar water and have a stick that's kind of coated with sugar and dip it in. And in a few weeks, you get these, you know, rock candy crystals.
Right.
And in terms of formation of the actual mineral crystals, how do they start forming? So in order for the rock candy to form, you have to have the sugar already there. But how do these even begin to form? Do you know the science behind that?
Well, there's so many different ways. I mean, that's one thing. But an awful lot of things just start because the material's there. And it may be liquid. I mean, at the time, it may be molten or not, you know, not really watery, but some movement. But they add crystals to the outside. So the crystal growth is not like plants. It is just like adding atoms of the same material on the outside until they get bigger and bigger. And, of course, if they don't have the space, I mean, they're up against something else. They can't grow any further that way. So they can become very distorted looking, even though they have an internal geometric arrangement that's fixed. They can be very distorted looking on the outside.
So, for instance, if you broke a crystal by accident that had, you know, been conformed, it would break and show that structure again. Is that?
Well, when you break things, you're looking at cleavage, which is different than crystal faces. So, and some minerals like quartz don't have a cleavage, so they just break irregularly and look like glass. Whereas fluorite, you know, breaks and people use it because they can take big crystals and they can make octahedrons out of them because that's what their cleavage is like. So when you see these big octahedrons of fluorite, that one over there is really a crystal form, but mostly they're cleavages. So, and some minerals have that and some don't.
Now, all these different minerals that you have on display here are different hardnesses, softnesses, and that kind of thing. I think we down in the last case down here, we had a bunch of things that would be popularly called semi-precious stones, but I think you probably want to disabuse us of that term.
Well, the reason that that's gone out of favor is that, you know, a long time ago, people dealt in diamonds, emeralds, rubies, and sapphires, and nobody heard of any other gemstones whatsoever. As gemstones have become more popular, some, you know, really inappropriate ones have become popular because of QVC and some things like that. But it's kind of get people to understand that, you know, gemstone does have some meaning. And you know, it should be, you know, beautiful, it should be durable, and it should be wearable. If they're not really wearable, are they really a gemstone? And that's what I'm trying to show here. Here we have fluorite and rhodochrosite and anglesite and sphalerite that all have hardnesses of 3 or 4 or less, which means that you can take a knife and scratch the heck out of them. It means that, you know, so much of soil it has quartz in it and sand and grit, which has a hardness of 7. So if you've got something that is going to, you're going to be wearing a ring and you're going to be, you know, doing anything at all, and you're going to hit it on something or hit it on this case or hit it on a piece of glass or hit it on, you know, it's going to be, you know, a mess in no time at all. They're not really wearable stones.
So what you're really saying is that some of these gemstones are ones that people, if they collect them, they would collect them in a display case of some kind rather than put them in jewelry.
Right, and some of it is the skill of the cutter, because you can well imagine that cutting a mineral that's very, very soft is a lot harder to make it look good than cutting something that takes a good polish, like, you know, even like quartz, like amethyst. It's going to be bright and shiny and durable, whereas if you're trying to cut something like a rhodochrosite, which is incredibly soft, it's very, very difficult to do.
I think one of my favorites in these cases is the opal. I just love how opal reflects the light differently. And I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about how opal forms.
Well, the difference with opal, which is it's kind of in a way not a mineral. I mean, it doesn't really exactly fit the definition of a mineral because it has water in its structure. And it's not really all that crystalline like other minerals. It has strict structures. Mm-hmm. But the problem with it is, because of the water molecules, it's subject to some of the same things like freezing and thawing. And this is why people have trouble with opals, because if you take an opal and you're out, if you're in here and you go outside and it's really, really cold, and those water molecules, you know, just like with the thing with a milk bottle, or, you know, putting freezing things in glass, and they expand and then they break. And that's what opals do. And so they're very, very fragile in that way, even though they're hard. They have a pretty decent hardness. They don't scratch, but hardness is just a resistance to scratching. And so they resist scratching, but they fall apart, you know. And some from some localities are not. The Virgin Valley locality, they're not very stable, and they end up with little cracks and everything in them.
We're in the University's Mineralogical Museum in Penny Hall, and we have just a few minutes left. We're talking with Sharon Fitzgerald, the curator. Now, immediately behind me is a case filled with little carvings that people have made out of different minerals, including a blue hen.
Yes, we had to buy that. I mean, I think it was on for a while. It was on the banner of the website. But you can see the different levels of carving, though. You can see that if you look at this, there's a malachite hippo. I mean, rhino, sorry. It's got a horn on it. And you can see it's kind of it's a very soft material, a lot easier to carve. You can see this carver doesn't have the skill that this bear has or this monkey. I mean, this chimp is out of one piece of agate. Those hands and face are not added. He uses the material, and it can change quickly, so you can see how difficult that is to do. We had an exhibition by him at one time. He's probably the finest living carver there is.
This
in
is
Germany.
Gerd Dreher.
Yeah. And the things he does are just incredible.
Thank you so much, Sharon, for letting us invade the Mineralogical Museum.
Well, invade it anytime you want and bring other people.
Again, the university museums are open Wednesdays through Sundays, beginning at noon, closing at 5, except on Wednesday, when they are open until 8, and they are free and open to the public. Thank you, Sharon.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official views or policies of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archive copies of this and other episodes, visit our website. Using all lowercase letters, go to www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark, or online at wvud.org.